shattered, so did the value of the funds. A gold ETF that owned very little actual gold bullion became a nearly worthless investment as institutions and individuals scrambled to cash out. The ETF bubble took the market by surprise, just as the housing bubble had done a decade earlier. The entire system collapsed like a trillion-dollar house of cards, catalyzing what would have been a small recession into an event that surpassed the 2008 financial crisis in terms of lost wealth. Hard-working people saw their 401ks evaporate and their pension plans become nearly insolvent. Retailers who were already teetering on bankruptcy thanks to online sales shut their doors and laid off tens of thousands of workers. There was a worldwide contraction of credit that stifled growth to a standstill. Everyone, wealthy and poor, suffered. Everyone, that is, but Vasily Andreyanov. He had shorted the equity markets in the United States, the United Kingdom, and across the European Union months before the attacks. That news alone had caused some uncertainty in the market since he was viewed as such a savvy, if shadowy, investor. Instead of looking to the world like the profiteering terrorist mastermind that he was, he came out looking like an oracle, the kind of mind that could lead a nation out of decline. Andreyanov pulled a tattered volume from the vast collection of first editions in his opulent library. Published in Russian, it was known to most of the world as The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was the only relic of the life of his maternal grandfather, a man he'd never met. His mother spoke of her father with awe, influencing young Vasily deeply with the political beliefs of a generation past. Unlike Andreyanov's father and grandfather, who were devout communists, his mother's father had been an outspoken supporter of Imperial Russia. He was a member of the Black Hundreds, an ultra-nationalist society that espoused a motto of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. The Black Hundreds despised anything and anyone who would challenge the House of Romanov, communists, Jews, and Ukrainian nationalists. The Black Hundreds had fought to suppress Ukrainian language and culture in Odessa, of all places, a feat that Andreyanov planned to repeat. Capitalism had defeated the communists. Andreyanov's attack on the world economies had punished the international bankers, and the next phase of his plan would finish the Ukrainians for good. A century after the fall of the empire, Andreyanov would rebuild what his grandfather fought so hard to protect. Chapter 22. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, March. After a hearty breakfast and 3 cups of coffee to get Reese's brain back in gear, he followed Rich toward the parking area. Rich reached behind the seat of his safari vehicle and retrieved a battered canvas rifle case that he handed to the new arrival. "You can use this rifle. It's old, but it works." Reese unzipped the case and pulled the big bore rifle out to inspect it. It was an old Mauser sporting rifle that looked like it had been carried to the moon and back. The bluing was worn from every visible surface from years of honest use, leaving the steel a burnished silver. The scarred walnut stock was the color of dark chocolate, and only small areas of the checkering at both the grip and forend remained visible. There wasn't a speck of rust or dirt, though, making it obvious that the rifle was heavily used, but never abused. Reese noticed some lettering at the top of the barrel that read, W.J. Jeffrey and Company, 60 Queen Victoria Street, London. It wore several proof marks, presumably from a house in England, and was marked 404 EX Cordite. He slowly cycled the bolt, which was as smooth as glass, pushing a cigar-sized round into the chamber. "How many does it hold?"
3 down, 1 up the pipe. The 404s are too bloody wide for the standard Mauser, but this one feeds like a charm. A gunsmith down in Pretoria took the sides out of the mag box to give it more room, so the rounds actually ride on the wood. I've got a couple of extra boxes of ammo for you, along with a pouch for your belt.
Rich dug around behind the seat and handed Reese a handful of battered yellow and red cardboard boxes with Kynoch 404 Jeffery 400 grain solid printed on the front.
All solid bullets? Reese asked.
Yeah. If you shoot this thing, it means that something is trying to stomp you into jelly. A solid is what you'll want. The softs won't penetrate on something like an Ellie. If you shoot an Impala or Warty for the pot, the solid will wreck less of the meat.
Reese nodded in understanding.
Carry this thing everywhere when you're not in camp, eh? You go off to have a shite and a dagger boy with a snare around his leg might decide to have a go at you, right?
Hastings laughed.
No sling?
When bad things happen out here, they happen fast. You want your rifle in your hands, not on your back.
Understood. How's the recoil?
Ah, not bad. The bloody English knew how to shape a stock, which helps. It's like a heavy shotgun load. Nothing a big, tough frog man can't handle.
Is there somewhere I can test fire it?
Sure. Louis will stop outside of camp on the way out this morning and you can have a go with it. Grab whatever you need from your room. He's gassing up the truck and will be ready to go in a bit. He'll have a cold box with food and drinks. Just take whatever you need for the day.
Got it. Thanks, Rich. I really appreciate this.
Reese held up the rifle and nodded toward it.
No worries, eh? Can't have a new friend getting stomped on his first day. Take the case, too. You'll want it for the truck.
Back in his room, Reese searched through his duffel to find the items he thought he'd need as a professional, well, whatever he was now. The temperatures were already rising to the point of being uncomfortable, so he wouldn't need much in the way of clothing. He found a tan ball cap with an old platoon logo on it and traded his flip-flops for socks and his Salomon hiking boots, which admirably looked none the worse for wear, considering what they'd been through. He clipped a folding knife onto the pocket of his shorts and put his backpack on the bed to take inventory of what was inside. He pulled out several items that he wouldn't need for this excursion and made sure that both his binoculars and camera were packed. He slipped the boxes of 404 ammunition into an outside pocket and zipped up the bag. Grabbing his Gator's sunglasses from the small bedside table, Reese picked up his rifle and headed toward the parking area. Louis was standing by a white Toyota Land Cruiser pickup, the workhorse vehicle for most of the underdeveloped world, supervising the loading of supplies while he smoked a cigarette. He spotted Reese approaching with his gear and nodded.
Mind if I throw my stuff in the back?
Just hand it to Moosey, eh? You can put it up front if you'd prefer. Hand him your rifle, too. He'll put it up in the rack.
Reese handed his cased rifle to the thin black man in coveralls who appeared to be in his 50s. Moosey placed the rifle in the rack behind the rear window with deliberate respect.
Do I need to get some water?
Reese inquired, still suffering a bit from last night's bender.
No, we've got plenty in the cold box.
Moosey, ipa iye diridza.
Moosey opened the cooler and handed down a 1-liter bottle of water. Reese nodded and thanked him.
What language is that?
It's Shona. Moosey is from Zim. He's been my tracker as long as I can remember. He's like an uncle to me. He understands English well, but it's more efficient for us to speak in Shona. Most of the workers in camp speak the local tribal language as well as Swahili and a little English or Portuguese.
Reese nodded.
Okay, looks like we're packed up, eh? You can jump up front with me. Moosey will ride in the back.
Reese noted a padded seat mounted behind the cab of the truck that would give the tracker a bird's-eye view as they drove. The Land Cruiser was a left-hand drive pickup with a standard floor shift. Though it was probably only a few years old, judging by the appearance, its lack of modern features made it appear to be from the 1970s. These stripped-down utility vehicles were virtually indestructible, but were also all but unobtainable in the United States. Reese had always loved using them overseas due to their dependability. Moosey tapped on the sheet metal roof and Louis started the motor, slipping the truck into gear. Three thin black men in olive-green coveralls were walking toward the camp on the narrow dirt track as the truck left the parking area. Louis steered the truck toward them and slammed on the accelerator. The men laughed and feigned fear as they scattered over the rocks that bordered the road.
Louis waved and said something that Reese couldn't understand as they passed. They drove with the windows down, fresh air filling the cab.
All right, you've seen the camp and Rich gave you the lay of the land on the map this morning. Today we're going to take a bit of a drive to the new block and check out some spots for buffalo, so you can start to learn your way around the concession.
Sounds good. This place is beautiful.
It really is special. Moses backward as hell, but there's so much potential. The wilderness areas are huge and the animals are really starting to recover from the war. If we can keep the poaching under control, this place will be paradise.
What do you do with poachers?
Well, half the time you run into a couple of guys that you know are up to no good, but you can't prove anything. We try to catch them with snares or guns, but if we don't, we basically try to scare them. We tell them that we know what they're doing, and if we catch them out here again, they're going to jail. If we catch anyone in the act, we call in the game scout and let him handle it. Rich wants to build a dedicated anti-poaching unit, but that's expensive and we'd have to fund it ourselves. It'll be worth it, but after buying this new block, I think it's a matter of resources. Maybe if you stick around long enough, you can help us train them, eh?
Happy to help if I can. Who do the game scouts work for?
They work for the government, for the game department. In most of Africa, you have to have a game scout with you when you hunt with clients. They make sure that the laws are followed and all of that. A good one is a real blessing, eh? But a bad one can fuck up a hunt right quick.
So, it's like taking the game warden hunting with you?
Exactly. We pay for them, of course, but we don't pay them directly because they don't want them to have a conflict of interest. They take tips from the clients, though, so it's not exactly perfect in that regard.
Are they competent?
Ha! This is Africa, James. You never know what you'll get. Some of them are as good as the trackers, but some come straight out of the cities and you have to keep them from getting lost. They're given AK-47s, but no training, so you just hope they don't shoot you in the bloody back by mistake when you're on a track.
Sounds like half of the Iraqi army.
I bet. Speaking of that, I hope Rich didn't talk your bloody ears off about the Bush War last night.
Not at all. I'd never heard most of that before.
Did he tell you about his sister?
No, he didn't mention her. I thought it was just Rich and his brother.
It is now. They had a sister. She'd be Rafe's aunt. I never knew her, but I know the story. She was an air hostess for Air Rhodesia. The terrorists shot down two flights back in the late 1970s using Russian missiles. She was on one of them. They killed something like 40 people when the plane went down. Then they hunted down the survivors and killed them on the ground. All civilians, women, kids. They bragged about it on TV afterward. Sick bastards.
No wonder he's bitter.
Yeah. Those guys fought a tough fight, but it's over, and some of them have a hard time letting go. It's never going to be like the old days, no matter how much they complain. Rich is a lekker bloke, but sometimes he lives in the past. It's an African thing, I guess. Louis's eyes narrowed as he took a long drag on his smoke. In Afghanistan, they're still using us to settle centuries-old grievances every chance they get.
Well, perhaps it's a human thing then, eh?
Louis took his foot off the accelerator and slowed the truck as they approached a wide spot in the dirt road. He turned off the track and steered the truck so it was perpendicular across the red dirt path.
Looks like a good spot to test that new rifle of yours.
Let's do it.
Reese opened his door and Muzi passed the 404 down from the bed. Louis said something in Shona and Muzi climbed down from the truck holding a panga, a utilitarian blade that was the African version of the machete. Reese retrieved his pack and laid it on top of the hood so that he could use it as a rifle rest. Louis handed him a rolled-up jacket to support the butt end. Muzi had walked 50 or so yards down the road and looked back toward them for approval. Louis flashed a thumbs up and Muzi used his panga to slash the bark away from a tree along the roadside, exposing the light-colored wood underneath. Reese now had a target. Reese expected Muzi would retreat to their position for safety, but instead, he walked a few yards off to the side and stopped.
"Go ahead and give it a go,"
Louis said, his binoculars already focused on the makeshift target.
"When in Rome, I guess."
Reese checked to ensure that a round was chambered and arranged Louis's jacket underneath the toe of the stock before leaning across the hood with the rifle. The back of his hand that gripped the forend rested on his back. He moved the safety to fire, found the silver front bead, and began to control his breathing. It occurred to him that the past weeks had been the longest period in 2 decades that he'd gone without firing a weapon either in training or in combat. He centered the bead in the express-style rear notch and arranged the sights on the target downrange, his eyes dancing between the 3 visual planes. He transitioned his focus to the front sight, exhaled slowly, and began to apply pressure on the trigger. Boom! The recoil was significant, as was the noise, and Reese was instantly reminded of his lack of hearing protection by the report of the elephant gun. He worked the bolt as the recoil pushed him rearward and chambered a new round as he returned his sights to the target. He saw Muzi move toward the tree and he moved his finger away from the trigger. Muzi used the tip of his panga as a pointer and indicated the bullet's point of impact, like the judge at a turkey shoot. The rifle's sights were zeroed perfectly.
Good shot. You want to give it another one?
Sure, can't hurt.
You have any earmuffs by any chance?
Ha! Yes, mate. Loud, eh?
Louis dug around behind the seat and returned with a pair of red earmuffs that he handed to Reese. He put them on and settled back in for a second shot, one that landed less than 2 inches from the first. Satisfied, Reese reloaded the rifle from the box of ammo in his pack. Muzi nodded at Reese approvingly as he took the rifle, returning it to the truck's rack. They drove on through miles of dense miombo forests broken occasionally by rivers or open savannas, with giant stone monoliths towering upward from the otherwise gentle terrain. Reese took it all in, awed by its savage beauty. The game appeared to be plentiful. Small groups of giraffes could be seen close to the road, their necks towering above the tree line like periscopes. Ever the guide, Louis would stop the truck and allow Reese to take in the scene while he passed along some knowledge about the species in question.
You can tell a male from a female by looking at the antenna up top, eh? Like a human, the bulls go bald on top, and sometimes you can see where they've bent them from fighting. See how the antenna are crooked on the dark one on the left?
Reese found the correct bull in his binoculars and took note of the askew headgear.
I see what you're talking about. Why is that?
They fight for dominance by binging their heads together sideways. When they do it, they'll often break something on the skull and those things get crooked. Must give them a headache, eh?
After a few moments, Louis started the truck again and continued on their journey. Similar stops were made to observe groups of impala, zebra, and a small herd of Cape buffalo. Unlike in the touristy photo safari camps that Reese had seen on television, these animals didn't stand around very long once the vehicle stopped. It reminded him of the difference in animal behavior in places like Yellowstone versus the backcountry wilderness areas where he'd hunted during his college days in Montana. About 2 hours into the drive, Reese heard a tapping sound on the truck's roof and Louis brought the truck to a halt. He exchanged words with Muzi and Shona for a moment before opening the door.
Muzi sees big bull tracks, elephant. Let's go have a look.
By the time Reese was out of the truck, Muzi was already handing Louis his weapon, a massive double-barreled express rifle with bores that looked at least a half inch wide. Muzi handed Reese his rifle next before climbing down from the truck's bed. Louis and Muzi stood over a large circular track on the dirt road, Muzi pointing at it while speaking rather animatedly in his native tongue. The PH knelt by the footprint and pointed out the various characteristics to Reese.
This is from a bull's front foot. We can tell because it's round. The rear track is more of an oval. These wrinkles are like a fingerprint. Every ellie is different. This smooth spot here comes from the back of his foot, so we know which direction he's moving. See how worn this track is? This is an old bull. Probably a big one. Definitely worth having a look at.
Reese nodded as he took mental note of Louis's explanation.
Muzi will lead the way. Just stay behind me. Stop if I